Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Welcome to the Kudzu Vine. It's June 26, 2011. I'm David McLaughlin, and joining me as always from Somerville, Georgia, Tim Shiflett. Welcome, Tim.
Make that a very stormy Somerville, David. Good evening.
Yes. And from Atlanta, Georgia, as always, Catherine Smith. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, and there's some thunder and lightning over here in Atlanta, too. So it's a stormy night in Georgia.
It's better than droughts. Well, not as much weather. I'm excited about politics tonight. We have lined up one of probably our premier guests in the history of the show, and no one who we've had on at different times. That's saying a lot. But David Neer, one of the founders of Swing State Project, who is now one of the key contributors at Elections at Daily Kos, is going to be our special guest coming up at 7:20. So we're very excited about David Neer coming on. But until then, we've of course got our own topics that we like to talk about. And last week we had a great guest. I was not with y'all. I hate it, but I know Tina filled in, and, of course, y'all did a wonderful job as always. But Dan Matthews, who was running for State House District 113, which is based in Oconee County, which is suburban Athens, Georgia. So Athens is where the University of Georgia is. Oconee County is more the suburban area, if you will. It's a Republican-held seat, and in recent years, Democrats have really – struggled in these. At times there'll be four Republicans and one Democrat, and the top two vote-getters will both be Republicans in these districts. And Dan Matthews managed to finish second and get into a runoff. So this, to me, seems like progress. Catherine, what do you think?
I think it's huge progress, and I think a lot of credit has to go to, I understand, Russell Edwards and Miguel Camacho worked very hard on that race, and there were some volunteers from the DPG who went up and did some calling and some door-to-door. So I think, you know, the work being done by volunteers and activists and DPG executive committee are proving to be effective, it sounds like. You never know exactly what worked, but...
Yeah, and I remember when we first started, there was a special election for Congress, which included Oconee County. Of course, it included many other counties. But there we had a pretty well-funded candidate, James Marlowe, running, and he didn't even get in the top two. The Republican handpicked candidate, James Whitehead, finished first, and then Paul Brown, who went on to win the seat, finished second. And James Marlowe, the relatively well-funded Democrat, was third. Tim, looking at that piece of history, what does it say?
Well, it says I'm in shock, for one thing, David. I'm sitting here looking at the election results now, and he did finish second in Oconee County, which is a huge step up. He won Clark County, of course, and he actually outpolled Williams, the top vote getter in Oglethorpe County. Not only did he make this runoff, but he made it easily. I'm just delighted. He ran a really good race. Did a lot of door to door stuff, and that's what you got to do when you are hamstrung by the fact that you don't have a lot of money, which he did not have, and so he took Tip O'Neill's All Politics is Local thing to heart. And good for you, Dan. You did great, buddy. Go out there and win that thing.
Yeah, I mean, it will be a very low voter turnout. I actually, y'all probably know since y'all had him on the show last week and talked to him live, but how many weeks until the general comes? Or not the general, but the runoff election.
I believe the 19th, ain't it, Catherine? July 19th.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So he's got some time.
Yeah.
And so it may be, it depends on which municipal elections happen to see how much turnout there'll be. But if it's a low turnout election and the most of the voters, he can get his vote out, then there's a chance he could win this. In a normal situation, this would be an incredibly uphill battle, and you may say, hey, it's just wishful thinking to think he could win. But in this type of environment, this may be a way to pick off a defeat. There would be obviously a very symbolic win because with the numbers we're down as Democrats in Georgia, one seat isn't going to be the whole thing by any means.
But it's an indicator. And I think that,
yeah.
I mean, we have to think that a lot of the trouble that the Republicans in Georgia have been having with all the, you know, with all the news of, you know, with the immigration problems, and apparently there are, he did express that does affect them up there. I think that that's another thing that is probably affecting this, you know, turnout of Democrats and performance of the Republicans. So it's a good indicator for the future, hopefully, you know. But we all have to get to work. I mean, there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Well, I guess staying in this, one thing that really caught my eye about this was there were four people, and Al Williams, I guess his name was, I'm trying to find his name as we talk, finished fourth. Alan, let me see if I can find his name. It won't come to me quick. Sarah Bell finished third. But this Alan fella, that his name's escaping me, he had the endorsement of country rapper Cole Ford. Alan Alexander was his name. Catherine, is this a sign that country rap is not as big as we thought it was?
I honestly, I know I don't keep up with music as well, but I don't think I had ever heard of country rap.
Well, I mean, I knew that Charlie Daniels' Devil Went Down to Georgia was country rap, even if it came out before rap music came out. I mean, it's basically speaking in rhyme. But then Cole Ford, I've seen this fella advertising a hamburger at Santa Fe Grill in Rome on some old placard. I'd never even heard of the guy. But then I got more familiar, and Blake Odd, the political reporter there for the Athens Banner-Herald, he had a little clip of his song, There's Been No Trash in My Trailer Since You Left, talking about his ex-girlfriend. I mean, this was some good stuff. And this fella couldn't bring Alan Alexander really even into the double digits, right, Tim?
Yeah, really. You actually listened to these songs, by the way, David, did you?
I listened to about a 5-second or 10-second clip of one that Blake Odd had on there.
Yeah,
I mean, there's been no trash in my trailer since you left town, I think it was.
Yeah,
I mean, that was poetry.
Let me just quickly say that's about 5 or 10 seconds more of it than I have listened to. And looking at these results so seriously, we know that Matthews voters are going to be coming right back to vote for him again. There's a good starting point. Looking at these other guys, who knows what their voters might or might not do. There weren't but 3,900 people voted in this particular election. We figure that's going to drop off precipitously. And I think this is the one time that a drop-off in the number of people voting will actually favor the Democrat in the race.
Yeah,
don't
I think you're right.
Yeah, and probably there may be a bit of thinking among the Republicans, hey, we never lose these things. I mean, usually it's us choosing between our own people. We've got this thing wrapped up, so there could be some real overconfidence during this summer election, the 18th or so, 19th of July. That's what we're thinking, hey, we can get our last vacation in before we end up going, you know, kids go back to school, what have you, around that time. So turnout may not be that strong. So we shall see, and best of luck to Mr. Matthews on, you know, the runoff election, because it would be a shock. And then, of course, that would happen, and he would actually, take his seats and get involved in the redistricting session. So he might actually be able to somewhat help in his new seat. And one thing he would have the advantage of course, Doug McKillop, the Democrat turned Republican that's to the left of many Democrats, in the state of Georgia is somebody that's probably not going to get any help in redistricting. And it could be that they say, hey, there's just too many Democrats in Clark County. Let's just wrap this Matthews guy's house in with most of McKillop's Democratic voters and just put all the, you know, and put McKillop's house in with all the Republicans, and we'll take care of him in the primary. I mean, that could be like the best case scenario for this fella. What do you think, Catherine?
That sounds like a pretty good scheme, actually.
Yeah. I mean, if the Republicans say there's no way that Clark County is going to have two Democratic seats, Keith Hurd hadn't won, and the McKillop district, most of that being the other, and here we have an incumbent, let's go ahead and just, you know, get this other seat back to the way we think it should be, and I'm speaking for the Republicans here. So, it'd be interesting to see what happens out of there. Well, I guess moving around and not having just Georgia topics for a minute, we had talked about Rick Perry and what type of Republican candidate he would make, and there's reports out late this week that he is inching even closer to a run. And then, of course, we talked about how Cinda Lake had on her Facebook page how strong he would be because the jobs argument. And I did hear Republicans talk about Romney's job growth in Massachusetts was just very anemic and how terrible it was, and they're hitting it with it. So obviously they're hitting Romney with poor job growth, and that seemed to play into strength for Perry. But, Tim, you're seeing that on Huffington Post and Drudge Report that Rick Perry may have new issues to face, particularly in a Republican primary.
Actually, they're not exactly new rumors. They are old rumors that surfaced as early as 7 or 8 years ago that have suddenly come to light again, and the rumors are that Governor Perry has had a couple of gay flings. Now, Fox News, in their report of this, blamed it on the Huffington Post, but like you said, these rumors have been around for at least 7 years, and the Drudge Report has been talking about it. The story goes that his wife knows about his flings, that he has had apparently with a couple of his aides, and his people have always publicly strongly denied it. But this is the type of thing that even if it's not true, might derail him a little bit with Republican voters. He's been getting very good press with the economic stuff and with people pining for someone different amongst Republicans to choose. And you just wonder how conservative primary voters will react to this type of story or if it will get any legs. But the story is out there. I'm sitting here looking at a story about it in the USA Today. So, I mean, it's out there. For what it's worth, David, I just don't know.
Yeah, so it's not on somebody's message board. 10 threads down, if you will, you know, somebody trying to trash somebody. These are legitimate news sources that are discussing it in some fashion. Catherine, what do you make of this?
Well, you know, I don't think it's any of our business, but I think that someone like Rick Perry, who is, you know, has stood with these strong right-wing, you know, moral policies and this, you know, whole thing, it's very hypocritical. And I think that's the thing that is disturbing. But I think that that's also the kind of thing that people will overlook. They'll, you know, I mean, we've seen a lot of things like this happen. And, you know, people will overlook things if they think that he's a good, strong right-wing guy, even though he, you know, if he has some explanation for it or if he just denies it and there's no proof, then I think depending on how much press it gets and how ugly the press gets about it, I don't think I mean, I think it might have some effect, but I don't think it ruins his chances, I guess, is my... Because I think,
well,
I mean,
I
think he's...
Go ahead, Catherine.
Go ahead. Well, I think he's the of ideal Republican candidate at this point. You know, he's got these strong, you know, Texas ties, and he's created all these, allegedly created all these jobs. And so, and he's very, he has been a very popular governor, not as popular recently as he was, but anyway, go ahead. I'm torn about it. I just wish we didn't have to talk about these kind of issues, though I think that Republicans should take heat for it because they've always been so, you know, stridently anti-gay against
the
gay.
Well, I think one thing you have to look at in this case is if it were a national election or New Hampshire was the first state, that may matter, but you're looking at an election where it's state by state by state. The Iowa caucus is first, and this is a state in 88 that Pat Robertson won the Iowa caucus over a sitting vice president and a sitting, I guess, had been majority and minority leader of the Senate at that point. Then two states later, or next, you have South Carolina coming up, one of the more conservative states on the Republican side, certainly. You know, these voters, you know, while America's getting more tolerant and probably swing voters are getting more tolerant and your Chamber of Commerce Republicans are getting more tolerant, the evangelical right-wing voters of the Iowa caucuses and the South Carolina primaries may not be moving near as fast as other parts of America on this. And nevertheless, it would still be a scandal because if he cheated on his wife with another person,
right,
be it a woman or a man, it's still the cheating that could still become the issue. There will be the deceit, whatever it may be. And you still have to talk about this. And if you're talking about that, you're not talking about the issues. And that's another problem because, you know, you'll have Romney and Bachman and Kane and keep naming the, you know, the dwarfs of the race are going to get to talk about the issues, and he may be talking about this stuff. Tim? How bad will it hurt him in Iowa in particular?
Let me just read one sentence from this article. We know who Politico is, of course. Politico is reporting that Perry's team is preparing to take on rumors that the politician is a homosexual. Whether it's true or not, obviously, his campaign team or his staff in the governor's office thinks it's a serious enough problem that they're going to have to talk about it and deal with. So it has at least gotten to that point. And if it gets to a point beyond that, of course it's going to be a major problem with Iowa caucus voters. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that the Iowa caucus, I mean, that is one of the most conservative electorates you'll find. And that's
right,
the first thing he faces. And, of course, at this point, I mean, he still hasn't decided. Had he jumped all the way in and then and this all this came out, then he may push through. But if he hadn't made the announcement, this may be just enough to pull back and decide not to announce.
Who does well historically in Iowa in the Republican Party caucuses? Values candidates, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Pat Robertson. Values voters represent a good chunk of the caucus goers. Yeah, a story like this is going to affect them. They've got to deal with this, and right now.
Yeah, and the Des Moines, Iowa Register poll just came out, and Michelle Bachman's basically tied with Romney, and of course Romney's kind of like the known commodity. It's a name recognition for him. And so Michelle Bachman, obviously a lady that got into politics because of a lot of her values, beliefs, is resonating with those voters. And so she's doing real well. You know, then you start having to take votes from people. Herman Cain, I believe, is in the top three or four in that poll. He's actually in double digits, whereas some elected officials are in single digits. So you can tell what the Iowa voters seem to like from that. Well, Catherine, our guest is going to be coming up any minute now, but until he comes up, because I don't want to push off too far,
You were at the JJ dinner for Georgia, a Saturday night JJ dinner. Give us a quick recap of what happened.
It was a really great event, I have to say. The keynote speaker, Ray Buckley, from the Democratic chair of New Hampshire, was great, very inspiring, very active Democrat. He's been working in politics for many, many years, back to the Carter election before he was even of voting age. Really very inspiring. He also spoke to the state committee earlier in the day. But the big news of the day, pardon?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. I tell you what, hold the big news. We'll get to that because that pertains to our show. But let's go ahead and welcome our guest on, David Neer, who founded or co-founded Swing State Project and is now one of the contributors at Elections at Daily Kos, has agreed to come on with us tonight. Welcome, David.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm glad you could be on again. David, first off, so people may not be familiar with like we are, because I know a few years ago we all talked about one of our leading news sources where we got information from, and this has been about 3 years ago, and Tim may remember this. I said that Swing State Project was one of my favorite blogs, probably my favorite blog to actually look for national political news to get research from. So we've been reading you for a while and using a lot of your content for years now on the Kudzu Vibe. But tell us how you got started with that blog.
Sure, and thanks so much for the kind words. I'm really flattered. I started the blog, the Swing State Project, back in 2003, and the name, there was a reason for the name. I was focused entirely on polling from the swing states in the 2004 presidential election. Of course, a little problem happened, which was that the election ended, and I still had this site. And I didn't quite know what to do with it because there weren't going to be any more swing states to talk about for several years. A good buddy of mine, Tim Tagaris, though, he convinced me to keep the site going, and we changed the focus to start looking at down-ballot races, so House, Senate, Governor, sometimes even more into the weeds than that. And we kept it going despite the confusing name because we weren't talking about swing states anymore. And I did that in my spare time for years and years until early this year when Marcos Militzas from Daily Kos wanted to bring me on board to write for him full-time, and we sort of just ported the site over from Swing State Project to Daily Kos Elections. So you just go to elections.dailykos.com, and it's the same great stuff that we've been doing all these years at Swing State.
Yes, has that had a big impact on the readership? Has that gotten you more readers, or what?
I think it has. Daily Kos obviously is a much bigger platform than Swing State Project. Definitely getting some more recognition. I get more emails now from campaigns, which is sometimes amusing. And it's been a really great move though. And of course, you know, I used to be a lawyer in my day job. I got to quit that and I got to write about what I love for a living. So it's a dream job.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to, of course, pass it around, but I do want to ask you about the governor's races before I start that. I believe this year there will be three governor's races, Mississippi, Kentucky, and West Virginia. Some of those are more competitive than others. Just start with which one you feel will be the most competitive and how you think it will come out.
That's a good question. I do want to add there is actually a fourth race, which is Louisiana. But that one I think
is... Do we have a candidate yet?
There's no one. There doesn't seem to be a single Democrat interested in running in Louisiana. It's pretty rough. So we could definitely set that one aside. Mississippi looks pretty brutal. There was a PPP poll out of that several months ago, and it just looks pretty hopeless there. We certainly didn't draw very strong candidates. So the two most interesting races are going to be West Virginia and Kentucky. And sort of the crazy thing about Kentucky, I've been really enjoying watching this race a lot, is that, you know, if you sort of have perhaps a passing interest in politics, you might think of Kentucky as this red state. Obama did very poorly there, trending away from Democrats. But the incumbent governor, Steve Beshear, is extremely popular and has been crushing his Republican opponent, David Williams, in the polls. And so I want to call it a competitive race. I would never want to take anything for granted, especially in a place like Kentucky. But it's looking very good for Democrats, and I think that's a very fortunate situation to be in, needless to say.
Yes, and then that West Virginia race, that was a race that's now an open seat because of Joe Manchin moving on to the U.S. Senate, and, of course, the acting governor, Earl Ray Tomlin, is one of the candidates, so he kind of is a de facto incumbent. What does that look like?
I also feel pretty positively about West Virginia for Democratic prospects. Tomlin, you know, like you said, he was the acting governor, and he faced a competitive Democratic primary, but wound up doing quite well. No one was really able to make much of a dent, and he has been fundraising quite well. The big wrinkle, though, is that the establishment favorite on the Republican side wound up losing in the GOP primary, and that was former Secretary of State Betty Ireland. And she lost to a businessman and total blank slate named Bill Maloney. Maloney seemed to have a lot more energy and certainly raised a lot more money than Ireland did. And Ireland sort of seemed to be expecting something of a coronation. And she had a very bitter loss. She didn't appear with him at a unity event after Maloney won the primary. I think she may still not have even endorsed yet. But like I say, Maloney is this blank slate. And, you know, in a state like West Virginia, you can't take anything for granted, though the GOP, you know, for the most part, has not had a lot of success there. So I would definitely slot that one as lean Dem for now. Want to keep my eye on it. Maloney's never run for office before, so that's a big handicap. But that'll probably be the most competitive race this year on the gubernatorial front, in my opinion.
Okay, so we control two, they control two, and at the end of the day, it may be exactly the same with some new faces in at least one of the states.
I think that's right.
Well, of course, Catherine Smith and Tim Shiflett are both here on with me and my longtime co-host, so I'm going to let them ask some questions, and it may come back to me for a few more if there's time. Catherine, what are some questions you have for David?
Well, David, thanks a lot for being on tonight. I know you've been very busy because Netroots Nation was just last weekend. So I wanted to hear how things went at Netroots Nation and how you think the sort of activists in that Netroots Nation are, what impact do you think they'll have both in some of these elections coming up in 2011 as well as, of course, 2012 and the general elections and all the elections in 2012 and what your thoughts are about that.
Certainly. So in case any of your listeners aren't familiar with Netroots Nation, it's a conference that's really focused around progressive bloggers and activism. And it's been going on now. It's in its sixth year, and it's gotten quite big. It's really one of the preeminent liberal conventions that happens every year, and this one was just in Minneapolis a week ago. It was the biggest one ever. We had something like 2,500 attendees, and it was an exciting time. I'd always gone to Netroots Nation as a vacation before. This was my first time going as part of my job, and I spent a lot of time meeting with a lot of candidates, mostly a lot of incumbents, but also a few challengers as well, some of whom look interesting, and I can get into that a little bit later if you'd like. In terms of the activists, the kind of people who are showing up at Netroots Nation, you know, the politicos of the world and the Beltway press loves to focus on conflict, even going so far as to, you know, almost make it up when it doesn't really exist. And so, you know, there were a few articles about, you know, a panel or two where, you know, some vocal folks expressed a lot of displeasure with President Obama. But the most interesting thing to me that came out of this convention was Greenberg Quinlan Rosner, a very respected Democratic pollster, took a straw poll of the event. And the straw poll showed that 80% of attendees have a favorable view of Barack Obama's job performance. So all this idea of, you know, the Netroots really being furious at Obama or, you know, potentially sitting things out, I think is complete nonsense. Is there unhappiness? There's no question about it. I mean, there are plenty of things that I'm unhappy about that the Obama administration either has or hasn't done. But I think people know what the stakes are, and people are going to be pretty motivated, especially to take back the House and, you know, give Speaker Pelosi a second shot.
Yeah, well, I think that you know, I've been voting a long time, and I've voted for presidents that I you know, truly admired, or candidates that I truly admired, who got elected or didn't get elected. And when they got elected, I was disappointed in things that they did. But I still have a great deal of admiration for them, even, you know, 35 years later. So I don't think anyone who thinks they're going to be I mean, there was a lot of misunderstanding, I think, about candidate Obama anyway. And I think we all, you know, hoped that he would be the ultimate problem solver. And of course, the president isn't that. But I'm very happy with his performance, and I'm glad to hear that he is getting that kind of support from the Netroots, because, you know, we all worry about it. Everybody worries about it, and it's nice to hear that it's not the case. So you said you talked to some candidates, and so what do you see coming up? And not necessarily specific candidates, but what kind of issues or what kind of candidates are coming up, and how might they change the sort of, if they will or not, change sort of the dynamics of the upcoming elections? Are there different issues coming up or different strategies, or, you know, how are things like the, you know, electronic media and all those kind of things, what kind of impact is that going to have on the 2012 elections, do you think?
Sure. You know, I mean, you're talking about issues, and I think, you know, this is certainly not new or original to me, but there's no question in my mind that Medicare is going to continue to really, really dominate. I'm sure you guys have followed along the special election in upstate New York back in May, where a Democrat won in a very difficult district, really because of the Medicare, Paul Ryan drumbeat. One of my fellow bloggers at Daily Coast has taken to calling the Paul Ryan budget Ryan's curse, and it's really, you know, I don't want to get too cocky or anything, but it's definitely been hurting them, and I see that as just being such a core central issue for the coming election. It's a little harder to know what else is going to really take center stage. I think, you know, if the economy, you know, sort of muddles along, you know, maybe it won't be as prominent an issue as it was in 2008 or 2010. If it starts to really look like a double dip recession, then all bets are off, and then I get very nervous again.
As we all do, for many reasons.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to pass this along to Tim, but if I have a chance, we might come back around.
Sure.
Well, good evening, David. Thank you for being on with us tonight, and I'd like to pay homage to you, too. I'm a longtime viewer of Swing State, and I've always posted on one particular conservative national blog, even though I'm like the House Democrat on that blog. And let me tell you that a lot of conservative Republicans have checked out David Neer and Swing State Project over the years. Just wanted you to know that.
Thanks.
But what I wanted to ask you about, you do a lot of talking about redistricting, of course, in your redistricting roundup. And what I want to know is, will the Republican election gains of last year, are you seeing that those are translating into major gains in congressional redistricting around the country?
The answer is no, and it's sort of a kind of perverse reason. After November of last year, of course, the GOP was riding high. They had won so many governor seats and also had won so many state legislatures. Except the problem is, when you win 60 seats in Congress, it becomes a lot harder to squeeze out any further gains in redistricting the following year. So what we've been seeing a lot of are, for the most part, Republican maps that are trying to shore up more vulnerable incumbents because they really don't have too much new territory to reach out into. And we've seen in a few instances so far, particularly Illinois and California, Democrats in Illinois with a very aggressive but amazingly sensible map that could give the Democrats five new seats in the House there. In California, There's this nonpartisan Citizens Redistricting Commission, which has basically taken a sledgehammer to the old lines and really started anew and really shook things up. And that's also going to shake out in favor of the Democrats. And then sort of to bring things back a little closer to home for Kudzu Vine in Florida, of course, the state passed these amendments to the state constitution last year, which require, quote-unquote, fair redistricting that is supposed to leave out political concerns like whether an incumbent will be safe or where an incumbent's home is. And if courts are aggressive in enforcing those laws, even Florida, which has really been sort of a charnel house for Democrats in the last several cycles, could open up several new seats for Team Blue.
Oh, okay, and of course, that leads me into the obvious next question, which is about the congressional elections themselves. What are we probably looking at next year? Are we looking at an election that where over 90% of the incumbents win re-election, as is normally the case? Or are we looking at something totally different and a lot of fresh new faces winning because of all this line drawing around the country?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. After the 2006 election, when Democrats had this big wave and a lot of Democrats were feeling really excited about the future, I started on Swing State Project. I said, you know, hey, guys, you know, you got to be cautious. You got to be careful. Two waves in a row, the odds of that happening are so small, you'll never see two waves in a row. And, of course, what happened, we had two wave elections in a row. 2009 rolls around, and I say, guys, come on, we had two waves in a row. You really think there's going to be three? You have to be crazy. And, of course, what happened, we had three waves in a row. So I'm very, very reluctant to make any predictions about 2012. I do think a lot of seats will be in play. I think double-digit gains for Democrats are definitely possible. The problem is that double digits doesn't get you to where you need to be. Democrats need 24 seats. That's not counting currently pending special elections. And I think that there's a chance, but I think it's going to be very hard.
That's an excellent answer. And with that, I'm going to pass it back to my co-host, David, for some more questions. David?
Yes. Now, obviously, we know that congressional elections swing pretty quickly, being every 2 years, but then U.S. Senate races are 6 years, and, of course, if 6 years ago one party has a big election wave, that means they have to defend more seats, and apparently, if you do the math, that means 2006 was a good Democratic year. That means 2012 there's more Democratic turf to defend. And some prognosticators are saying that makes it tough for us, particularly in the South, and you can include border states like Missouri and West Virginia if you want to. What are some of the key battleground states in our part of the country?
So it's interesting that you mentioned Missouri, and I do agree that the gains in 2006 are going to make 2012 very challenging for us. In Missouri, of course, we have incumbent Claire McCaskill, who won very narrowly in 2006, and she looks like she's in the fight for her life. All the polling has shown the race extremely tight. She's probably going to face off against Republican Congressman Todd Akin. The advantage for McCaskill there is that Akin is very conservative, probably too conservative for his state, and has also staked out a position very strongly in favor of Ryan's curse. At the same time, Akin also has to face a Republican primary, and he could wind up being a little bloodied and bruised from that. So I would call that race very much a toss-up right now. Another race, Florida. Florida's looking surprisingly good for us, or maybe it's not surprising. Senator Bill Nelson seems to, unusually among senators, have a lot of crossover appeal. Now, when I say a lot, it's not like he's getting the votes of 50% of Republicans, but he's getting something around like a quarter or more. And in this polarized age, that really does count as a lot. Democrats are, you know, not usually so excited about him, but I think in the end it won't matter. I think they'll come out to vote. They'll certainly come out to vote for Barack Obama. And I'm feeling pretty good about Bill Nelson's chances. Just to sort of run through the rest really quickly, I guess West Virginia, I have a feeling that, you know, we're back to GOP fortunes in West Virginia. After seeing Joe Manchin just totally destroy John Race last year, despite the enormous GOP wave. It looks like the Republicans there in the Mountain State are not really eager to line up to run into the Joe Manchin buzzsaw once again. So I think that's probably a pretty solid hold there.
Yeah, I mean, and around the South, I guess there's just not really a lot of seats open, and some of them have incumbents. Like Tennessee, Harold Ford ran a very close race in 2006. Like, anything changes in his favor, he possibly wins. But then a very unpopular Republican among his most staunch supporters is kind of getting a free pass sitting there in Tennessee.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yeah, I mean, Bob Corker, is there any chance that a Democrat comes in and makes a race out of that, or is that just no, there's no room there?
You know, we haven't really heard any names of anyone who's interested in making the race. I never want to write anything off, especially it's still early. You know, we're only halfway into the odd-numbered year of the cycle, but I'm not optimistic about Corker, though. I think you make some good points about, you know, his sort of relative popularity or perhaps lack thereof. But he really may wind up getting a pass. You know, the one other race, of course, is in Texas, which is going to be an open seat. I think that's also going to be a real challenge. Depends a bit on who the GOP nominates. You know, we have General Ricardo Sanchez running for us. Looks like he's probably going to be the Democratic nominee. I think he can probably make the race more interesting than perhaps we might have otherwise expected. It also depends, on if Barack Obama decides to maybe make a little bit of a feint into Texas to try to draw GOP resources away from other states. But right now, I would put Texas on my watch list rather than really rate it as competitive just yet.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that candidate up, because that's something we hadn't discussed on the Kudzu Vine. And, of course, in Tennessee, we're all waiting for Basil Marceau to come in. I don't know if you're a big fan of him, too, but we're big fans of Basil Marceau, even though he stood us up one time. So
he did
shows
stand us up.
Infatuation for Mr. Marceau.
Did you guys ever get Dale Peterson on?
We actually sent out a challenge one time to Dale Peterson, because he got involved in our governor's race out of the blue. But actually, I don't know about Catherine and Tim, but I think I'd rather have Basil. I guess he went on Jimmy Kimmel, and he got so big time that we just have a chance anymore.
You'll have to settle
but you never
for me.
Know. Well, I mean, hey, that's a pretty good consolation prize. But you named your blog the Swing State Project, and that's the only thing we hadn't asked you about that we had talked about. But I know Catherine had talked about wanting to ask more questions as well. Catherine, is that what your questions were about, or do you have something else?
No, I was going to ask about the I guess it is related. What you think the swing states might be in 2012 for President Obama? What states are looking? You know, we all hope that we'll be viewed as a swing state. We don't know if that's really possible, but there always is conversations about that. In fact, at the Jefferson Jackson dinner, Ray Buckley from New Hampshire was our keynote speaker last night, and he talked about Georgia being in play a little bit. So what do you think? What are the states to look at for 2012?
I feel the playing field is going to be probably pretty similar to 2008, and I think that's very bad news for the GOP. I think that there's a few states that Obama is very unlikely to recapture again, principally Indiana. I think that's going to be hard. But, you know, he can lose Indiana, he can lose Ohio, he can lose Florida, and still win pretty convincingly. I feel like Virginia is definitely going to be in play, no question about that. North Carolina, you know, Obama, that was one of his closest margins. And I think that North Carolina will still definitely be in play. Georgia is such a fascinating state. It was definitely one of the closer states that Obama lost in 2008, as I'm sure you guys need no reminding, though still, you know, a bit of a distance away. But, you know, if it doesn't happen in 2012, Georgia's going to swing soon. The demographics seem to make that inevitable. And at the very least, Georgia is at some point soon, like I said, if not 2012, then maybe 2016, Georgia's going to be in play. And when that sort of thing starts happening, when Georgia's in play, and then when maybe even Texas is in play, then the GOP is playing serious defense on the presidential level, and it becomes incredibly hard for them to to have a path to victory.
Yes, we have a lot of work to do in order to make that happen, but
yeah.
I think we're getting ready for it. So,
yeah,
well, I'm excited for you guys.
Yeah, and staying with this, since we have you on the line, David, and it was one topic we were going to talk about, on your site, actually, elections.dailycos.com, on Tuesday, you reposted a Vanderbilt University poll. They're pretty smart at Vanderbilt. I think they know math up there. They have President Obama leading every Republican candidate. He leads Mitt Romney 37-35, but some other candidates, like, say, Sarah Palin, he's up 43-29. Is a state like Tennessee, which actually John Kerry, I believe, did better in than President Obama in 2008, could this possibly be a swing state, or does Vanderbilt have a little funny math?
You know, I think I don't want to get excited about this one. We had a big internal discussion over at Daily Coast Elections with myself and various co-writers about how to handle this poll and what did it mean and could it possibly be right. And I think the key takeaway is not the margin between Obama and the Republicans, but what Obama's numbers actually are. You know, Obama's obviously the sitting president with 100% name recognition, and everyone probably has pretty strong feelings about him one way or the other. And if he's in the high 30s or low 40s at this point, as we say, there's not really a lot of room to grow. And if I may be mistaken about this, but I also think that Vanderbilt in their poll wording may have specifically even prompted respondents to say if they wanted none of the above, and that's or if they wanted someone else. And that's not necessarily a bad thing to do, but the fact is, you know, there really isn't anyone else. You know, we have the GOP field more or less pretty clear who the possible nominees are, and obviously the Democrats only going to be Barack Obama. So sometimes if you offer people a choice like that, it's sort of a false choice. And the number of undecideds was really, really high as a result. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I would not want to get my hopes up based on that one poll.
Yes. Well, we did, of course, want to discuss it with you since it was reported on your site, or at least that's where we saw it. And, David, thanks again for coming on with us and sharing your knowledge, and you're welcome anytime on the Kudzu Vine.
Well, it's really been my pleasure, and I'm only sorry that it took so long to get me on. And thank you guys so much for the very kind words and for having me on the show. And thanks for everything you guys do.
Thanks for everything
you
do.
Thank you,
sir. We really appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye.
Yeah, well, and we may not talk to David for a few weeks, but we'll definitely be reading him in a few days, if not before then, because I think we said we all read his blog and get information, and of course, it was worth the wait. Well, we got two things I definitely want to accomplish before the end of the hour. One, Tim, is you have an outrage, and they're always great. And, Catherine, you were in the middle of the wrap-up of the JJ dinner. We can go either way. Tim, you've put pen to paper. Do you want to go ahead and wait for after the JJ wrap-up, or do you want to go now?
You choose. You're the host. Go ahead,
okay,
Catherine.
I'll tell you what. For continuity, let's let Catherine finish her discussion and give us our big news that was announced, and then out of that we should have plenty of time for the outrage and then a little bit of wrap-up on that.
Okay, well, the big news of the day and evening was the announcement of the selection of the new executive director for the Democratic Party of Georgia, and that person is Paige Gleason, who we all know and love and has been very active in Democratic politics and nonprofit fundraising in Georgia for many, many years. She was the executive director of the Young Democrats of Georgia, the executive director of the Fulton County Democrats, a founding member of the Win List. I think she was president, or she served on the board of Red Clay. And she, of course, had her own political consulting company for a short time, and she is, you know, steeped in Georgia politics and is very excited to be coming back to Atlanta from New Orleans, moving back next week and starting on, I believe, July 6th at the new headquarters for the Democratic Party of Georgia over here on the west side of Atlanta, northwest side. And everybody was very excited and I think it's a great choice. I, of course, was on the search committee, and I looked at all the resumes. We had some great candidates, but no one with the necessary background and experience and skills that are required to really pull this party ahead and raise the necessary funds and build the organization in a way that can, you know, turn us blue in as soon as possible. I don't want to say that we're going to make a huge dent in 2012 because we have a lot of work to do, but we're all hoping that we'll have some success in 2012 as well as, you know, moving forward. But we also had John Lewis as received the first John Lewis Lifetime Achievement Award, which will be awarded each year to, you know, important someone who's contributed important in important ways to Georgia Democratic politics. He was on fire last night, like always. He was, you know, the classic John Lewis, telling us all to get in good trouble and stop the Republicans. And we had a wonderful address from one of the state senators from Wisconsin, who was part of the Wisconsin 14, who left the state in order to stop the voting on the anti-union legislation. She was fantastic. Her name's Lena Taylor, and I think we'll be seeing her in the future. She was really dynamic and really riled the crowd up. So it was a great event. Lots of people, everybody stayed until the end, which is always refreshing. I think that's because it was Saturday night. But I was really pleased. I looked around as John Lewis was getting off the stage and everybody was there. And then Ray Buckley from New Hampshire was the final speaker. And even at the end of his comments, the room was still quite full. And I know you guys have both been to JJ dinners where the most dynamic speaker, and it's very hard to follow John Lewis, the room just starts to empty, but it didn't happen last night. And one more thing, I'm really pleased to say that my friend Melanie Gu, who has contributed in so many ways to so many candidates and so much for the Democratic Party of Georgia and the county parties, received the Murphy Award from the 5th Congressional District. And a lot of great people received Murphy Awards last night, so that was really nice too.
Yeah, I do want to ask you, because I saw a comment on Blog for Democracy. It said, the JJ dinner was much better than I expected it to be. And I think we have to be honest. You know, we're used to JJ dinners where John Kerry and Howard Dean speak, a sitting U.S. senator, a sitting governor. At the same time, you know, Vice President Al Gore spoke more than once. I know Tim and I have been down together one time when Al Gore spoke. I mean, we're used to this level of speaker. And now I'm echoing in our old friend. Is this the best we can do for speakers going into it, at least?
Well, I think, you know, we did have some scheduling problems and, you know, got our date sort of late in the game. I'm sure people were disappointed. Everybody always wants, you know, some big-name person to come. But I have to tell you that Ray Buckley was really good. I mean, he really put us to the test. You know, he was like, you know, Georgia can be in play, but you have a lot of work to do. Much more of the message last night was much more of sort of a rebuilding message. You know, we have work to do, and the work is in your hands. That was sort of the message, both from Congressman Lewis and from State Senator Lena Taylor and from Ray Buckley. And I think, you know, dedicated Democrats in Georgia understand that that's where we're at right now. And, you know, those speakers, you know, there can be a lot of expense involved in bringing those big speakers, not necessarily fees to them, but, you know, the expenses around security and travel. And you know, I think there's, I mean, I think people were disappointed, but we had a full room, and we had a lot of fun. There was live music. There was, you know, people singing, and, I mean, I think it was a great event, and I don't want to detract from that by saying that, you know, it could have been better. Sure, you know, it probably could have been better, We could have had Michelle Obama, but we didn't. But I think everybody had a good time last night.
Yeah, and speaking of 2008, the president still offered us a visit to a JJ dinner when Hillary Clinton came, and he didn't. Somebody ought to remind him of that. At some point, if he does want to make this a swing state, he ought to come to a JJ dinner and help the party actually raise money so we could actually fund that effort. But I mean, I just want to keep it real and, you know, and be honest and say things
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. I think people were expecting someone more notable, but I do think that those people who were in the room last night, I hope were inspired by the stories from all three of the speakers. They were all very dynamic and very inspiring, and I think that's, you know, sometimes you sort of have to reset your expectations to something like that instead of just someone who's famous.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to mess up anybody's expectations about the kudzu vine. We've promised an outrage of the week, and Tim, now it's time. I hope you're ready.
Oh, yeah, I'm ready, and I want to do one quick piece of housekeeping. David Neer, if you're still listening, how about doing a story on the Wisconsin recall, because we didn't get a chance to ask you about that. That being said, I saw Mitch McConnell on one of the morning talk shows today, and he was talking about the budget impasse in Washington and the national debt. That's a favorite topic of the Republicans nowadays, at least while there's a Democrat in the White House, it is. And he started that same little bunch of talking points that he and the other congressional Republicans had just about talked to death. You know what I mean, stuff like, we need to cut spending, followed by Social Security and Medicare are going broke, and we're going to have to make some hard decisions about them. And my personal favorite that they talk to death is this one. The private sector is who is going to create the jobs, so we shouldn't penalize them with a tax increase. Well. In the first place, the Republicans should be ashamed to even mention the national debt. Nearly 60% of the national debt was run up under two presidents, Reagan and Bush, 43. So their track record is not exactly one to be proud of on this subject, and I personally don't trust them for one moment to do anything about it. I don't know, it would be like giving a machine gun to a monkey or a geography award to Michelle Bachmann. There are some things you just don't want to do. And the Republicans always mention Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid. Now, why is that? I mean, other than the fact that they hate these programs and had nothing to do with their inception and want them destroyed, why is it always the social safety net that they want to whack? Do they just not care anything about the elderly or the poor? What do they think here, that maybe these worthless 80-year-olds need to get a real job, or that a single teenage mom in the inner city of Detroit can actually afford Blue Cross Blue Shield? I mean, what next? Should we cut out the school lunch program? Hey, how about the whole rotten public school system? Or should we cut out some government departments? Speaking of Michelle Bachmann, she has this idea that we need to cut out the Environmental Protection Agency. She said is the biggest jobs killer in the country. Good thinking there, Michelle. If there's anything this country needs, it's unregulated businesses poisoning our land, air, and water. I mean, you know, since that worked so well in the past, geez. Anyway, now, I'm certainly in favor of balancing the budget, just like the next person. I mean, I cheered and made fun of some of my conservative friends and everything when, you know, a Democratic President Clinton did it. But frankly, there are four places to get the kind of money you need to do that. Our Republican friends seem to be stuck on two of them, as already mentioned. What about the other two? For starters, no Republican is uttering one word about the defense budget, and I find that to be amazing. The United States accounts for 43% of the yearly defense appropriations for the whole planet. If we cut our defense budget in half, we would still spend three times the money that the number two country on the list, China, spent. And in one fell swoop, we'd have over 20% of the money we need to balance the budget. But they're not going to do that because in the political world, they might look soft on defense. And we certainly can't lose an election in order to do anything that's right, can we? And yes, for those of you out there drawing a mental picture, I did just wink when I said that. And the fourth place to get the money we need is the last place that conservatives of any party wish to go to, and that is the land of taxes. The Republicans in Congress, along with some of their blue dog brethren in the Democratic Party, are declaring tax increases, quote, off the table. And here I was thinking we had an emergency. I mean, Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor said so. Okay, so I do have a news flash right now for the Eddie Munster twins. If we do have an emergency, then everything has to be on the table. That includes taxes. That also includes closing loopholes for the rich and corporations, which would net us tens of billions of dollars per year. But no, the Republicans inform us that amounts to a tax increase as well. They not only want to butter the bread of the fat cats, they want to serve it to them in a silver basket. All I hear about are cuts, and all the cuts I hear about are programs that are favored by Democrats. And the only people I see being asked to sacrifice are people who would vote Democratic, like the poor, for instance, or minorities, or little union teachers in Wisconsin, or my family. Maybe you listeners out there, your family as well. This week, the Republicans walked away from the negotiating table, seemingly willing to let the country default when the debt ceiling is not raised. They say we don't want to meet them in the middle. They don't want to meet in the middle of anything. Their idea of the middle is not the middle anymore. Their idea is for all of us to agree with them on everything. That's their middle. We have to be willing to stop this somewhere. The future of this country might depend on it. And I'm not willing to trust this country to a bunch that was elected by people dressed as Paul Revere who have no idea what Paul Revere even did, David.
Tim, your outrage should go on the tail end of Robert Reich's video that's on YouTube and moveon.org. Well, it's been a great kudzu vine. And want to thank David Neer. Can't thank him enough for coming on, and hopefully he had a good enough time that he'll want to come back. And thanks for his kind words on his post at elections.dailycos.com. And Catherine, thanks again to you for going to the JJ dinner and giving us a report last night.
And congratulations to Paige, and congratulations to the Democratic Party of Georgia for hiring her.
Yep. Good evening, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Good night.